This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
Bismillah, alhamdulillah, wa salatu wa salamu ala rasulillah wa alihi wa sahbihi wa man wala. So, once again, we have the opportunity to share thoughts about some of the things that I've been reading recently. This is our winter reading list that perhaps will enable us to while away those long hours in these dark winter evenings. And it's our custom to look at five books, which hopefully will enable us not just to learn more about our heritage and the world, but will enable us to inhabit the modern reality in a more informed way. So my first pick this year is a book by the American Jewish author Daniel Boyarin, which he calls The No State Solution, and he's a professor of Jewish studies, Talmudic culture at the University of California at Berkeley, and one of the most distinguished Jewish intellectuals writing in the academic world nowadays. His book, Carnal Israel, is a really interesting and Islamically actually quite suggestive account of the way in which Jewish knowledge is always embodied in forms of engagement with the body, with water, with ablution, circumcision, and so forth. But the book that I'm looking at, which is his latest book, is about the current unfolding catastrophe in the Middle East, whose ripples are now spreading far and wide, including creating, I think most recently, the largest ever demonstration in Cape Town, larger even than the anti-apartheid demonstrations 30 years ago. So a global crisis focused on Jerusalem, ultimately. So The No State Solution, A Jewish Manifesto by Daniel Boyarin. We always hear about the two-state solution, which is rather forlornly the dream of the Foreign Office and various dialogue pundits, but of course it's clear that so much land has been taken on the West Bank now and Gaza is kind of a pile of rubble that the idea of a Palestinian state is a kind of pipe dream, frankly, in the current scenario. Netanyahu has said he's against a two-state solution. One-state solution, maybe. I was talking once to a settler rabbi in Jerusalem who was saying there'll be a one-state solution. Everybody will be able to move and live wherever they like in Greater Israel, but the vote will be only for Jews. So it'll be a democratic state, but a Jewish state, and Christians and Muslims will be allowed to live and enjoy citizens' rights, but they won't be able to vote, and that's how we'll maintain our identity. Something like that may well be a possibility, but Boyarin is proposing this cheeky title, The No State Solution. He begins with a kind of statement of his own agonizing as somebody who has spent his life with the Jewish text, Jewish communities, Jewish tradition, a religious man, and who really loves his identity, his Ahlul Kitab identity, but is completely alienated by the reality of Jewish nationalism in the Middle East. So he loves the people and the idea of the people as a nation, but not the idea of the people as a nation state. So let me just read to you his explanation right at the beginning so you can see what he's doing when he says no to a national energy or enterprise for the Jewish people. After literally decades of obsessive thought about the Jewish question, I seem to have gotten myself into an aporia, a dead end of thinking with no way out. One way of describing this impasse would be that two of my most ardent political commitments to full justice for Palestinians and to a vibrant, creative Jewish national culture seem directly to contradict each other. It would seem as if the only way to fulfill the latter dream is to support the existence of the State of Israel. But clearly, the existence of the State of Israel makes the first dream impossible to fulfill. The forms, moreover, that this Jewish national culture takes in the Jewish state have always been problematical. Inevitably so, I would argue, given the premises of such a state, even when pursued with the best will. This best will, furthermore, turns more and more sour almost by the day. It seems almost inevitably so. The nation state is well on the way to being a racist, fascist state. Given the choice between justice and my culture, my nation, I have no choice but to choose justice, but the loss would be insupportable. So he's explaining this trauma that's actually shared by very many Jewish people, that on the one hand they need to express their fullness as a nation with a law, but on the other hand they can't rest easy in their homes when they know that their homes have been taken from another ethnic group, and they have to find ways of shutting out that ethical paradox. So here he, in the book, reflects on Jewish authenticity as something that, following the destruction of the temple, has always existed and flourished and has found its identity in diaspora as minorities. That is where Jewishness is most authentically to be found. And that the moral paradox of existing as a triumphant state while sitting on the head of a captive population is not Jewish and cannot be allowed to continue. So it's quite a good read. There's plenty of other books by anti-Zionist Jews. Of course, Shlomo Sand is very interesting with his The Invention of the Jewish People. He's a Tel Aviv historian who's written this very meticulous book. They've tried to pull it apart, but the reviews have generally been favorable, even in the Israeli press, where he says that the Palestinians, by and large, as far as we can tell, are the descendants of the ancient Israelites with lots of admixture from everywhere. But the Jews who returned following the supposed exile, the Romans expelled them, he says that never happened, from around the world, are largely the descendants of converts. So the Eastern European Jews, the Arab Jews, the local populations that then were religiously assimilated into the Jewish people. So that's a very interesting read. And he's also very alienated by the whole Zionist culture, which he sees as inevitably, given differential birth rates in Israel, slanting towards more and more Zion-religious, ultra-nationalist electorates. So he's written a book called Why I Am No Longer a Jew, which raises interesting questions about whether you can stop being Jewish. But that's also interesting. But Muslims who see the current conflict as a kind of zero-sum game between different religions need to be aware of this very vibrant Jewish minority dissident opinion that is about looking for an authentic Jewish identity in diaspora. So Boyarin definitely on my list. Kind of relatedly, I've been reading a bit about, and this is my second pick this year, about the catastrophe, the Holocaust, if you like, of the Native American populations. You might have noticed that dozens of churches have been burnt down in America recently by Native Americans as an expression of their outrage at the way in which, using Christian ideology, quite often using biblical terminology, their countries were taken apart, they were ethnically cleansed, destroyed by alcohol, destroyed by venereal disease, destroyed by militant Christianity and a series of massacres. And actually, of all the American races, the demography that's most supportive of the Palestinians in the US at the moment is actually the Native Americans. So this is one of the most kind of heart-rending books by Theodora Kroeber, Ishi in Two Worlds, the best-known book by and about Native American culture and spirituality. Of course, Black Elk Speaks, which is also really moving, and anything about the Native American experience tends to be sobering and depressing. But in the context of Muslims living in America who need to know what is indigenous and the fitra of their people, who are looking, for instance, of ways of decorating mosques and identifying with not the settler cultures, but with what is indigenous, because that's what Islam always does, it's important to understand these people. So this is a book about this guy, Ishi. It's not even his name, because in his tribe, you could never pronounce your own name. You had to be named by somebody else. And he was the last survivor of his tribe. There were hundreds, maybe thousands of them. Then the white man came. He's from California, from the Yahi tribe. And they were massacred, murdered, poisoned with alcohol. And he was the very last survivor, the last speaker of his language. So he wasn't even able to tell the people who finally found him what his name was. But he was kind of adopted by the Californian academic establishment when he was finally found, having been alone. Everybody else was killed from his nation and brought into civilization. And he learned English, and he became a mine of information about what California was like. And it's very interesting, because the usual stereotypes of the Red Indian being shot down by John Wayne as he kind of screams and hollers and scalps the white man and does the usual kind of things that the other will do, America's Palestinians, is what a kind of refined person he was. Here's somebody who, before the age of 50, had been living a kind of Paleolithic lifestyle. These are hunter-gatherers. They didn't even have villages. They wandered up in the hills of California. And then at the age of 50, he's brought in, they give him a suit. He sees railway trains for the first time. He sees skyscrapers. And what they're amazed by is his extreme courtesy. He's not the wild man, kind of a Fred Flintstone, Stone Age man. He's extremely polite. So they take him to dinner parties in California, and he's unfailingly courteous to the women. He always looks down when he's speaking to them, always polite to them. The idea of the savage, even the noble savage, is not present. He's quite bewildered by the obsessiveness that the white man has for building high, for achieving things, for subduing the landscape. He doesn't see the point of that at all. When you see photographs of him, you see the kind of hieratic tribal dignity of his face next to these smirking anthropologists who have the kind of disturbed, anxious Western face. And the difference between them is quite amazing. So just to read a little bit, this is kind of the summary of who these people were. It's quite a good spiritual as well as an ethnographic account, because these, like all primordial peoples, were people who worshipped the Great Spirit, who saw the divine in the divine signs in nature, who were very hygienic. Every morning at dawn he would get up to pray, but would wash before he prayed. A fitri human being. So, the California Indian was, in other words, a true provincial. He was also an introvert, reserved, contemplative, and philosophical. He lived at ease with the supernatural and the mystical, which were pervasive in all aspects of life. He felt no need to differentiate mystical truth from directly evidential or material truth, or the supernatural from the natural. One was as manifest as the other within his system of values and perceptions and beliefs. The promoter, the boaster, the aggressor, the egoist, the innovator would have been looked at askance. The ideal was the man of restraint, dignity, rectitude, he of the middle way. This is often a Native American way of saying what we would call a sirat al-mustaqim, balance in all ways, sometimes called the red road. So it's, if you read it, it's uncannily similar to some of the most foundational aspects of Quranic religion. The idea of the elements, the idea of the indicativity of nature, the idea of restraint, the idea of, well, polygamy is there, but a kind of strict separation of the genders in terms of function and in terms of presence. They didn't do free mixing very much, not the California red people. The idea of different times of day being suitable for different forms of worship, the idea of a lunar calendar. It is kind of North America's true Sharia, if you like. And when I was last year in Arizona, I was interested to find that Muslim communities there have a good relationship with the Apaches who are on the reservation. And of course, the white man's tools, particularly alcohol, are continuing to oppress those people. A very great tragedy. One thing the Israelis haven't been able to do, of course, is to poison the Palestinians with alcohol because they don't drink. It's part of the problem. One reason why the reservations are Gaza-sized rather than little American reservations. You just can't poison them with or anesthetize them with alcohol. So I found this book very moving. It's not too technical, anthropological, but it's a very good portrait of this guy who was treated, you know, by university as a kind of curiosity, almost as an exhibit. People would come to the university museum and ask to see the red man. And then after he died, even though he had certain requests for how he would be buried, they didn't respect that, of course, and they even took his brain out and sent it to the Smithsonian in Washington to be analyzed, along with millions of other Indian relics that they have. Apparently they lost his brain for a while, but finally when they started to change in their attitude to the red man, it was sent back to a related tribe, and it was buried in a secret place so the white man can never change his mind. But a traumatic story, but also a reminder that, you know, the fitra is universal, and human beings, when they live in a primordial way with nature, respecting the seasons, the sun and the moon, the presence of the Great Spirit, become people of tremendous restraint and dignity and not savages. Pick number three this year is this book. It's a very humble production. Love's Secret, A Journey to the Beyond. No author, which is unusual in these egotistic times, particularly, you know, academics are on the catwalk all the time saying, look at my stuff. But not for this lady, and it's fairly clear that this is female spirituality. It's that thing that we used to do a lot as an ummah, which is what used to be called shatahat, or theopathic locutions, Orientalist phrase. That is to say, inspired words that try to capture the perfume of a particular moment of lived experiential proximity to the divine. So it's not poetry, but it's, as you can see, set out, so there is not very much on each page. And the anonymous authoress is using a spare but quite evocative language in order to try and document her spiritual state, which is clearly inspired by Rumi and the Sufi tradition. I want to be taken into meditation, drawn into the depths. I don't want to sit with a straight back or force this relationship with the beyond. I want my eyes to close slowly because they need to, because I'm carried. I want this to be a feminine experience, a beauty, a soul. One day I may be ready to go completely, but for now, please just continue to be patient and kind. I used to think this light was mine. Now I see it was never anything to be owned and never something to keep. Simply a gift you gave, which I can offer back to you with the sincerity of my heart and the purity of my intentions. I have found the more I have taken, the less I have. I have been given time to take the responsibility of this life seriously. What more could I ask for? I have been given space to pray. I have been given a heart that cries. What more could I ask for? I have been given sunrise after sunrise. I have been given the black of night. Really, what more is there to ask for? Now I will take each step forward, honestly, respectfully, compassionately. It is you who sees from my eyes and loves from my heart. Birds sing, I hear them for you. I come to you in need, wanting nothing and everything simultaneously. My prayer is a prayer of rest and of silence, knowing I can never be enough except through the kindness of your mercy. So many times you make it possible for me to breathe again, and so many times I forget you in need and remember you in love. So as you work through these simple expressions of what is traditionally called munajat, like the munajat of Khwaja Abdullah Ansari and of Ibn Ata'il al-Iskandari, who has the Hikam, but also his famous munajat, his intimate conversations with the divine, you get a sense cumulatively as you read through these meditations and these little prayers of the particular fragrance of the writer's experience, the nafha, the exhalation of the divine. And in our age where Islam has become quite externalized, people don't write too much about God and their own experiences, but they all have a million views on madhabs and sharia and politics. I think it's important to get back to this particular voice and to remember that the essence of religion is the personal experience of proximity to al-qarib, the near. Quite a nice gift as well, I would say, because it's a kind of basic hardback, but it's a nice looking thing. So it's a kind of present for people, I don't know, weddings, Eid presents and so forth. I dish them out whenever I can. So we move on to my fourth pick for this year. Jack Miles, God in the Quran. He's not a Muslim, he's an Episcopalian American who's written a book called God, a Biography, which got the Pulitzer Prize a few years ago. He writes in the New York Times, and it's a kind of well-known voice on the interpretation of religion. And he's written a book about the God of the Quran, coming to it as a kind of open-minded, open-hearted, curious American of the best sort, worried about the growth of sort of Trumpian Islamophobia in his country, and looking at the Quran and its portrayal of the divine with a fresh objective eye. It's not an academic book. It's not packed with footnotes. But he's done a lot of reading in Islamic literature as well as with the Quran. And his conclusions are very interesting. The American evangelical kind of warmongering stereotype is of Islam as this religion of the sword, not a religion of peace, and Christianity as being the religion of Jesus, meek and mild, turn the other cheek, and therefore better. And his comparison, actually, even though he's not quite at ease with it and isn't quite sure where to go with it theologically, he leaves it really as a question, is that it's kind of the other way around, which is not what he expected when he began his quite meticulous study of the Quran. So he begins by talking about, you know, how the Bible ends with the violence of Jesus at the end of time and the violence of the language, which is very important for American evangelicals, was used a lot in the war on Iraq when it was thought that Iraq was Babylon. Babylon would be overthrown. God would give victory to Israel. The mosque would be destroyed. The temple would be rebuilt. There would be lots of trumpets sounding and Christ would come again, which is a view many millions of evangelicals in America and in kind of prosperity gospel environments in places like Africa believe in, which is, you know, Armageddon type language. But this idea of the violent Christ with his eyes of fire and feet of brass who comes to hurl the unbelievers into eternal fire. I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he shouted aloud to all the birds that were flying high overhead in the sky, "Come here, gather together at God's great feast. You will eat the flesh of kings and the flesh of great generals and heroes, the flesh of horses and their riders and of all kinds of peoples, citizens and slaves, small and great alike." And it's important for Muslims who are trying to understand American violence that's often supported by the evangelical right and American support for Israeli maximalism, that they're reading all of the Bible, and particularly this consummation of the Bible as many understand it, and its foretelling of the end times and the violence that Christ will be unleashing. So he begins by talking about, well, this binary, peaceful Jesus and the warmongering idea of the seerah. Maybe it's not like that. So he then goes and looks at the specific stories, particularly of the prophets as recounted in the Bible, and goes through them one by one. Job and Jacob and the casting out of Ishmael, the fate of Hagar, Joseph, all of those stories, Moses, and particularly looks at what Bible specialists call the text of terror, which is the extreme acts of ethnic cleansing and aberrant violence that are endlessly attributed to the prophets and their adherents in the Hebrew Bible, the Herem, the sacred extermination. God says to Moses, "Write this down in a book," this is biblical, Book of Exodus, "to commemorate it and repeat it over to Joshua, for I shall blot out all memory of Amalek under heaven. Now go and crush Amalek, put him under the curse of destruction with all that he possesses. Do not spare him, but kill man and woman, babe and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and donkey." So God in the Bible is ordering his prophet to massacre not just combatants, but also the women and the babies and even their animals. This ban of extermination is kind of regarded as absolute. Now, can you imagine if a verse like that had appeared in the Quran? Wipe out their babies and kill their animals. Fox News would be reciting it several times a day. It would be their favorite Quranic quote, but it's kind of biblical. And this is the kind of text that Netanyahu has been citing in order to give religious explanation and context for his campaign in in Gaza. So what he does as he moves through the Bible and looks at the Quranic stories is to conclude that all of these horrifying things, modern Christians find them kind of horrifying, a lot of Jews find them kind of not Jewish, they're taken out from the Quran. You don't get these massacres. The psalm that says, blessed is he who takes the babies of the Babylonians and dashes out their brains on a rock. That doesn't appear in the Quran. The story of the dubious stories about the prophets, so Lot sleeping with his daughters and Solomon hankering after foreign deities and all of the very dubious tales, even the story of Abraham, the binding of his son. In the Bible, what he sees as a rather nasty touch is that Abraham doesn't tell his son that he's about to kill him. It's going to be a kind of paternal surprise. In the Quran, of course, the first thing that Abraham does, alayhi salam, when he sees the dream, is to go to his son and to say, this has happened. Fanzur ma tara, what do you think? He consults with him, so he knows exactly, and the son consents. So Miles's view is that the Quran consistently ethicizes these chaotic stories about the biblical God and actually ends up giving us a greatly improved view of Jewish history, that it becomes ethical. It's the opposite of anti-Semitic, because it's taking out and reforming and saying, these stories are not true. Your prophets, your story is actually really ethical and really beautiful. So he ends, you know, with some interesting reflections, what to do with this. So he says things like this. He's quite smart. I recognize a brilliant symmetry in how Islam combined Judaism's criticism of Christianity with Christianity's criticism of Judaism. Christianity insisted against Jewish tradition on universalizing God's covenant with Israel to include, in potential, all of mankind, dissolving Israel's privilege in the process. Islam accepted this critique. The Muslim Ummah is as universal in aspiration as the Christian Church. Judaism insisted against emergent Christianity that as God alone was divine, there could be no two powers in heaven. Jesus was not the Lord, only the Lord, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, was the Lord. Islam accepted this critique. There is no room in its theology for a divine Christ or any other power associated with the one and only God. From each, by a kind of radical simplification, Islam took was most precious and most defining, and yet at the same time eliminated from each what was most problematic. From Christianity, it stripped off the doctrine that had produced, by the time of Muhammad, endless controversy and multiplying sectarian division, while from Judaism, or from the Jews as a people, it stripped off the sense of privilege as the one and only chosen people of the one and only God. So by the time he's got through all of these stories and done this work, he's kind of really transformed, that the Quran represents exactly the solution to these ethical difficulties and these theological problematics, and kind of gets the best, as he sees it, of the two religions and creates a new religion with it that ethicizes the whole story of monotheism. So I can recommend this, God in the Quran by Jack Miles, wholeheartedly, I think. As a good refutation of Bible bashers who say that Islam is violent. They need to kind of have their noses rubbed in the pages of the Old and the New Testament and, you know, asked to read this to see what the comparison really looks like when a kind of open-hearted American Christian is prepared honestly to do the work. So my final book this year, Political Again. It's been a very political, disruptive 12 months. John Gray, who is a professor, just retired, I think, at London School of Economics, he's a philosopher. The New Leviathans, Thoughts After Liberalism. Everybody left and right, Spectator readers, New Statesman readers, take a deep breath. What do you mean after liberalism? Aren't things getting more liberal, more woke, more tolerant, more inclusive, more diverse? What does he mean after liberalism? Are we sliding back into Nazism or some kind of divine right of kings world? Well, he's looking, first of all, at the philosopher Hobbes, Thomas Hobbes, author of The Leviathan, perpetual whipping boy for many historians and philosophers and political scientists. But the Hobbesian view is that in a state of nature, man is a wolf to man, and that we need the state, the Leviathan, in order to restrain things from collapsing. It's the Islamic idea of the wazir. There must be a religio-cultural political entity that stop the weak being devoured by the strong. Hobbes, quite an Islamic thinker in many ways. So Gray is thinking, he's not a Christian, he's not religious, following the decline of the Christian order, or the theistic order generally in the West, which underpinned values. We have this slide towards massive inequality, towards more authoritarianism in many parts of the world, that the 1989 to 1991 euphoria, the kind of Fukuyama end of history bliss, at last history has reached its consummation and it's over, because the Soviet Empire has fallen and the future is with democracy, human rights, liberal capitalism, etc., the final solution. Darwin has been proved right in the human sphere, has been disproved by the fact that history is certainly back with us. We have a major war in Europe once again. We have a multipolar world in a way that we haven't seen really since the 19th century. America diminishing, defeated even in Afghanistan. We have the rise of China, we have the rise of India, we have the rise of Russia, which is generally fielding sanctions pretty well and looks set to win its current war with NATO, which is essentially what it is, NATO doing everything in Ukraine except pulling the trigger. And in this very unstable world, liberalism is very much on the defensive, even in the Western world itself. So he points to the new authoritarianism, particularly in campuses, and those who work in a Western university know how strict the speech codes are, what you can say about Israel, what you can say about sexualities, what you can say about the list of issues on which there is quite rigorous censorship continues to grow in the name of a certain type of woke orthodoxy. So he says this, for instance, in schools and universities, education inculcates conformity with the ruling progressive ideology. The arts are judged by whether they serve approved political goals. Dissidents from orthodoxies on race, gender, and empire find their careers terminated and their public lives erased. This repression is not the work of governments. The ruling catechisms are formulated and enforced by civil society. Libraries, galleries, and museums exclude viewpoints that are condemned as reactionary. Powers of censorship are exercised by big, high-tech corporations. Illiberal institutions are policing society and themselves. A global pandemic, accelerating climate change, and war in Europe have hastened these transformations. But they began, as many historical reversals do, with the apparent triumph of an opposite trend. Greeted in the West as an augury that liberal values were spreading worldwide, the Soviet collapse was the beginning of the end for liberalism as it had previously been understood. So he doesn't really talk much about the Islamic dimensions of this, but it is important given the kind of preachy nature of so much Western discourse about other cultures and about Muslims, Muslim immigrants, and why won't they be like us and World Bank loans to countries in the Muslim world that are conditional on progress, on women's rights, and alternative sexualities, and the fuss that they made during Qatar, that the Qataris were not going to change their laws and their values and their structure of the family in order to please Western woke orthodoxies. The idea of the West as the exporter of a kind of coercive liberalism, which is actually the opposite of traditional liberalism as understood. So the regrowth of empire, the regrowth of a multipolar world, and the collapse of the dream that the West has triumphed, something that Muslims, as they're searching for their own place in an increasingly multipolar world, need to reflect on, that we're in a very strange transitional time in which Western triumphalism really, as Gray amply documents, no longer works. With the collapse of the religious basis for Western civilization, new orthodoxies are being imposed, and the future direction of the West is unclear. Demography as well. of course, the birth rate across the industrialized world is collapsing, and there's no sign that that will be reversed. So immigration, demographic transformations, all of this is going to make the future look unstable, certainly, but it's not the West as the end and the summit and the consummation of history, the way that Fukuyama and Huntington and many other sort of evangelicals for Westernness were thinking 30 years ago. So quite a useful reflection coming from a secular perspective on the sort of Spenglerian thesis of the decline of the West that now unquestionably seems to be happening. So that's the end of my reflections on what I have been reading in recent times, and I think all of these things from their very disparate perspectives are going to be useful to us, and inshallah we'll always remember that empires come and go, ideologies come and go, peoples come and go, Zionisms come and go, nationalisms come and go, Islam remains. Ja al-haq wa zahaq al-batil, in al-batila kana zahuqa. Falsehood is just a kind of froth and it passes away. And the only thing that's certain about the future is that, you know, Islam will continue to be there and its basic forms will continue to be maintained. Alhamdulillah, wallahu ghalibun ala amri. Inshallah, we'll be enjoying the rest of the winter, and may Allah bring us safely to Ramadan as wiser, humbler, more reflective, more optimistic Muslims, inshallah. Barakallahu feekum wal afu minkum. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.